appears we're starting with William Burroughs.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to present. I'm going to share with you some data from two arenas. One, work that we've done on terrorism, where we can put together hypothetical scenarios. There's also some real data from terrorist attacks. I'm also going to look at, share with you some data from a national panel where we collected data in response to the financial crisis. This might be important to give us insights if there were some, say, cyber attack that were to compromise our financial systems. The financial stuff I've done in conjunction with colleagues Ellen Peters and Paul Slovic, and the terrorism stuff with Adam Rose, Tony Barrett, Ergun Bayrak, and James Giesack. What we're working on right now with officials from the city of Los Angeles are three types of potential calamities that could affect the Los Angeles area. Earthquakes are a big risk, obviously, in Southern California. We're also putting together a chlorine release where terrorists hijack some tanker, rupture about 3,000 gallons of chlorine in the downtown area, probably by the Bonaventure Hotel, that area, and a dirty bomb scenario where they get hold of some cesium or something like that, rapid and conventional explosive, detonate in the downtown area. What's interesting in our selection of these is that the earthquake will do widespread the most damage, particularly property damage, some business interruption, casualties for a 6.5 earthquake, probably in the range of about 100 to 200 people. Dirty bomb, casualties for most scenarios that the Department of Homeland Security thinks about, probably not more than 100 people. Everyone expected to die will die from trauma, not radiological effects. That's not how the public will perceive it. Chlorine is by far the most lethal. And scenarios that are plausible are in the thousands, and in some cases tens of thousands, will happen very, very quickly. A few hours after the event, the chlorine will dissipate. But what our prediction is from past research is that the terrorism looms large. And of these three scenarios, the dirty bomb will result, we think, in the most business interruption. It'll take a while to determine what areas can be brought back into play. But getting people communicating about radiological risks is extraordinarily difficult. Lots of fear surrounding it. It's a big challenge. And so we're trying to look at this and also estimate the costs, the economic impacts of this, orders of magnitude due to the psychological response. Paul Slovic and I, a couple of years ago, conducted a thought experiment, and I wrote the math, the differential equations to build a systems dynamic model. And we predicted a couple of years ago, this is a published paper, where following some traumatic event in a community, fear ramps up very, very quickly. And then if this is the visceral fear, anxiety, worry, stress begins to come down slowly. And we're now beginning to think in terms of half-life, that is, how long does it take before the public reaction is about half of where it was at the peak? After 9/11, our model predicted that this would be about 60 days out in the community. This is quite consistent with findings from surveys that were done after 9/11, where they queried people about their levels of fear. Notice also that people's perceptions of risk, not their visceral response or worry, comes down a little bit much more slowly than does fear. And fear doesn't go to zero. Media coverage ramps up quickly, and then it moves on to other things. And I want you to sort of picture this model here, because now I'm going to show you some real stuff. Colleagues of mine looked at the London bombings, 2005, July. This is the econometric model up here that can act as a counterfactual. This is what would have happened had not the subway bombings occurred in terms of ridership. This is what, in fact, did happen. Notice this steep drop. Now, this isn't all due to fear, of course. A couple of those stations were out of commission for a few weeks. Here's the steep drop. Then there's a slight tick up towards recovery. Then there was the second bombing. Correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think anyone died in the second bombing. No. Okay, so here we are now, so we see this steep descent. At this point right here, all the stations were now operative, and yet still we see this inertia quite consistent with our systems dynamic model. And as an aside, I mentioned this to Mark in the last session, that when he talks about this escalation, de-escalation of a thing, we can model this with a systems dynamic model. And what we think is going on is that with this recovery, communities don't sit on their hands when there's an emergency. People engage, they reassure people, they want to restore normalcy as quickly as possible, but it takes time. Half-life here, about 45 days. Oh, 45 days, and by me, what I mean by half-life is, how long does it take to close this gap, essentially? About 45 days there. Colleagues looked at the hit to the commercial airline industry. This is the forecast, the econometric models of what would have happened. The aviation commercial airline was already a little bit in trouble before 9/11. Here's what actually happened. We see this steep drop. If we look at how long it took to close this gap in terms of passenger miles to about half, it's roughly about 90 days. 90 days. If we now go to another arena, this is the financial crisis. This is the VIX index. Sometimes economists and financiers, this is the fear index of investors. The technical term is the expected volatility over the next 30 days. If you were to trace this back, even going back to 1990, you'd see it's down at this levels. The announcement of the Lehman Brothers collapse, this begins this steep ascent, just like our model predicts. Right here, notice that there's this precipitous drop right here on the day after the election. This is Barack Obama effect. It goes right back up, and as I like to say, that it dropped very quickly, went right back up, because we realized we had not elected Moses or Jesus Christ, but rather just a regular guy, admittedly very smart guy, very capable guy, right back up. But once again, we have this slower return out here. Right now, a few days ago, we were at about 28, so we're out about here. So we see the same sort of dynamic. Just as a reference point, the week after 9/11, where there was so much concern that the stock market was shut down, we were at 44. This is up at 80-something. This is just how much concern there was. And the reason is, the difference is that for investors, 9/11 was regarded as an external shock. The crisis here, we realized there were some fundamental problems with the economy. Here is a national panel that we are doing with regards to the financial crisis that we coincidentally launched on the day of the largest point drop in U.S. history, September 29th. That wasn't by design, but it was written up in a Wall Street Journal a couple days later because of the timing. Notice here, these are very fearful. Now, this isn't just moderately fearful, these are very fearful. Percentage of people up here, this is about 40 days later, they're at about a third of where they were up here. But still we see, and the point I want to emphasize here is, during this period, there was not really one scrap of good economic news. Even so, the fear begins to come down, like this. In other words, we recover as a community. This is risk to perceived risk to retirement. Notice that just as we predict that risk doesn't come down as quickly as fear does, this is for women. Notice that there's a gender effect here. Guys, it may not work that quite way. This seems to be much steeper than for the women. But this is people's perceptions. It didn't really decline. There's still a lot of concern about what will happen to their retirement. Here is anger, and this isn't just regular anger. This is very angry. This is outrage. And we know this because we also asked, in addition to this, 1 minute, okay, is that that there are a lot of very negative feelings about Wall Street. Market confidence haven't changed. Last slide. And this is really important. Here is Obama, Senator Obama here, President Obama here. If we conclude moderate trust, we'll see it almost virtually mirrors his job approval ratings. But look at this, business leaders. I had to modify the scale. This is if business leaders keep up the good work with women, they should be up to about 2% by the first of next year. This is very, this, you know, we laugh about this, but this is, we look to this community to protect a lot of our savings and retirement investment, and there's enormous outrage. All right, I'm done.
Zamina.
Okay, thanks. Quickly introduce myself. I'm Chris Cocking from London Met University. Going to talk to you about the work I do, which is the collective mass behaviour of how people behave in emergencies. And I'd like to push the concept of collective resilience as well. Okay, so where do I come from? Mark Levine spoke earlier, I come from a social psychological perspective on security. I'm a psychologist, but what we as social psychologists do is we look at the collective rather than individual responses. How do people behave in groups and large groups? And my particular area of interest is mass emergencies. So every time there's disaster, I get accused by my colleagues of being an ambulance chaser because I'm right in there going, what happened, and etc. We're inspired by social identity self-categorisation approaches to psychology, looking at the how we have multiple identities. So you have identity as a person, but you also have identity as a group member, as a fan of a team, as a member of a particular nationality, as a male, as a female, etc. And all these identities operate in tangent with each other. We also take a less pessimistic view of human nature than classic social psychological paradigms. Classic social psychology experiments such as Zimbardo-Stanford Prison Experiment and Milgram's conformity studies appear to take the view that human beings can't really be trusted, that deep under the layer of civilization we're all selfish and atavistic. And the social psychological perspective we take says, as Mark said earlier, that's only a partial story. There are many opportunities where people can be a force for social good, and crowds and groups can facilitate that process if the conditions are right. Okay, so quick history story then. What inspired most emergency planning facilities that have been happening is the panic model. It's a kind of hodgepodge of many different theories based on a crowd observer called Gustave Le Bon from the 19th century, who very much believed that people in crowds were prone to irrationality, metaphors such as the mob, herd mentality, etc. Crowds couldn't be trusted. So in emergencies, you're faced with a threat and you become emotional, you become fearful, and that fear causes your reason to become overwhelmed. You cannot make rational choices when you're faced with a threat. Therefore, your collective identity breaks down. You don't have any concern for people around you. Number one is the most important thing. You've got to get out. So therefore, you behave selfishly. You push, you trample. This is classic cliche that in emergencies, one would trample over their own grandmother to get out if it would help their survival. And then finally, which is draws directly from Gustave Le Bon's theories, is the concept of contagion. If one person starts behaving selfishly and irrationally, everyone else will join in, and that behaviour will spread like wildfire within the crowd. Now, if you assume these behaviours, this has direct implications for emergency planning. And as I hope I'll show, the models we use are very critical of these approaches. So an approach that was developed beyond that by Tony Molson, British academic who's based in the United States, is the social attachment model. He argues that in emergencies, people behave in affiliative ways. They affiliate towards known people, their friends or their family who are in a crowd. Social norms rarely break down. And this certainly is an improvement upon the panic model. But there's disadvantages, because it argues then that if you stay with your group, you stay for the weakest group members to evacuate the danger, you will then escape successfully or die as a group. So while it's an improvement, and it's supported by sociological evidence, such as Benjamin Cornwall's done a lot of evidence on behaviour in fires in the United States, there are problems with it. And there's two main problems. It's that if you affiliate to people that you know, if you're in a crowd of strangers, which is what most people in emergencies are, therefore, you're more likely to behave in a selfish way, because why would you have any attachment bonds to complete strangers around you? Secondly, it can't explain for the observation, the evidence, that strangers do appear to cooperate in emergencies. Okay, so this brings in the self-categorisation approach. which is an approach that I use, and obviously I have a vested interest, but we would argue that it's kind of the dominant approach to crowd behaviour at the moment, certainly in the United Kingdom and in Europe. It argues that disasters can create a common identity or a sense of we-ness. We're all in this together, we're all in the same boat, we've got to work together to get out. So this results in orderly altruistic behaviour among strangers, as people escape this common threat. And in direct opposition to the panic model that says a threat causes your collective identity to break down, this approach argues that an increased threat can actually enhance the common identity, because the greater the threat, i.e. the greater the threat to survival, the greater the need is for your group to work together to be able to escape that threat. Now, this is supported not only by psychological and sociological evidence, but we've also found this concept of spontaneous resilience can occur. And a good example that we found, which is drawn from evidence by Catherine Tierney, who did a lot of work on 9/11, that after WT7 collapsed, the Emergency Operations Centre was in WT7, so their command and control centre went down. But there still was a remarkable amount of spontaneous planning, that meant that despite the human tragedy on 9/11, it was a remarkably efficient evacuation, in that I think 99% of the people who were below where the planes hit in the towers managed to evacuate and escape. And the people who were above where the planes hit unfortunately perished, but had no way out within the time that the towers collapsed. So it is supported by evidence. So I've got 4 minutes left. What I'm going to do, I'm probably going to have to quickly rush through this, is the thing I do with my students, is that when we were doing the project, we Googled in some images, and we thought, right, we'll Google panic 9/11. This is an image of, after I think the first tower has come down, as people are evacuating from the dust cloud. Now, clearly, you can see the gesticulation on people's faces, there is clear fear going on. But is this panic? And I'd just like to pick apart a few things. I won't have time to go through all of them. The woman in the pink T-shirt, bottom right-hand corner, is still wearing her high heels and still carrying her shopping. She hasn't dropped it. She hasn't kicked off her heels, which would facilitate a quicker evacuation. There's a guy in the back. Can you see the guy in the back holding up a silvery object? That's a camera. He's taking a photo. Guy in the front. Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't have one the other way around to see what he's doing. But in relation to that point, the guy in the front, he's got his hand up, he's holding his jacket, he's gesticulating that. Now, I'm extrapolating a bit here, but I think he's saying to the person taking the photo, get out of the way, run. Showing clear concern for someone else, people are all respecting each other's space. So while they are clearly fleeing a threat to their lives, because if they didn't, they may well perish, I would argue that, ironically, this is a classic example of non-panic behaviour. Okay, so there's some implications here. Sorry, did you want to ask them?
Well, I don't study anything about panic. Do you have a picture of panic behaviour
to compare it with? I've got one in my USD. It's a drawing of the Chicago fire. But it's just, it's people hypothetically speculating. I can show you that later, and it does show what the author thought panic would be, of babies being thrown in the air and stuff like that. I'll show you that later, but it's just a drawing. So there's many accounts of panic in emergencies, but what actually is panic, and what is logical flight behaviour? And we need to look at what people actually do to decide if it is indeed panic. And there's problems here, perhaps, with the definition. And people do get fearful, but do they actually panic? And this isn't just semantics. It's not just we're looking for a new word. Because if you assume that people panic, it has implications for emergency evacuations. Okay, so I'm probably going to run through this because we've only got a minute and a half left, so by all means grab me later if I don't go into enough detail. There's implications during the incident that you need to communicate information to crowds more, because if there's problems in the crowds, and we're not denying that there aren't problems, it's usually a lack of information. We would argue that there's no evidence that people in crowds actually panic if they know the scale of the threat. If you provide useful, sensible information that people can act upon, they usually do. People are more likely to under rather than overreact. And as I said, the problematic behaviours people might have, such as freezing, narrowing their focus, denying the nature of the problem. And these are all problems because they can have fatal consequences. But I would argue this is a lack of panic as opposed to panic, because they don't recognise the urgency and the need to evacuate. If there is overreaction, it's usually because people are acting as individuals and not as a group. A classic example we had in the UK in 2000, we had a fuel crisis. in that people resorted to panic buying. The press announced there was panic going on, and all the petrol stations ran out of petrol very, very quickly. We advised the media not to use the term panic buying, because if people as individuals hear that other people are panic buying, they're going to run out and fill their tank as well, because they don't want to run dry. And that is what caused the pumps to run dry. It wasn't actually the blockade of the refineries. So, I'm going to have to rush on, because I've got 14 seconds left before the music comes on. There's implications post-incident resilience. This is an area we need to look at in more detail. Does this unity, does this resilience last? Can people endure after the event? And does this have therapeutic consequences, i.e. for PTSD? And final quick summary. Crowds can behave much better than they're often given credit for. The panic model is largely a myth. Panic behaviour, if it occurs, is usually confined to individuals. It rarely spreads, and others usually intervene. Crowds can be part of the solution rather than the problem. They're often referred to as the fourth emergency service. And this has direct implications for how we approach safety and security of mass evacuations, public order, etc. There's a list of references there, and if anyone wants any questions, by all means, grab me afterwards.
By the way, if anyone has the... It looks like a USB hard drive that goes in here, and it's what allows people to advance the slides with this thing. If your one was connected to your laptop up here yesterday and you took it, then please bring it back for the next speaker.
Thank you. I'm Richard John from the University of Southern California. I'm a psychologist, and I've been working with CREATE, which is one of the DHS Centers of Excellence university programs to study events related to terrorism, although lately we've referred to these as asymmetric threats as opposed to terrorism, and have minimized the use of the T word, it seems. You might ask, fear and loathing. We've worked hard to create fear and loathing in Hollywood. It's tough nowadays with Joe Torre and Manny Ramirez there. Everyone seems chilled out. They're certainly much more chilled out than they were here or in New York. But what the focus of this talk and of our recent research has been on trying to understand something about the process of social amplification of risk. This is a phenomena that seems to characterize a lot of different actual disasters, not necessarily just terrorism, but a lot of other disasters as well. There are relatively small losses directly following the event, but there are much larger losses due to simply changes of human behavior in the medium and long term. There are very few examples of under-response or the opposite of social amplification, perhaps social de-amplification. The one that comes to mind is the San Francisco 1906 earthquake and fire, where essentially, of course, there was no FEMA in 1906. There was no rush to show all of the damage so that we could get more federal money. And in fact, what they did was they put out the word that only a few hundred people had died. In reality, they had no idea how many people died. They didn't go and try to recover every single body and do a count. They put out that a few hundred people died, but we're open for business. The damage, they very strategically took pictures of San Francisco at the time that were not so bad, and actually probably avoided a sort of attenuation of their growth at that time. Lots of examples more recently of social amplification. Santa Barbara oil spill, pretty much those of you who are old enough can still remember the birds with the oil dripping off of them, sort of killed the offshore drilling in this country for a long time. Three Mile Island, although Schwarzenegger may bring that back because we're broke in California. The Three Mile Island nuclear power plant incident coupled with Chernobyl pretty much killed the nuclear power industry in this country, although given concern over global climate change, that may be coming back too. And of course, post 9/11 travel shifts due to a fear of flying. And you could extrapolate that to a number of other public or government acts that were taken as well. We've actually simulated what would happen from an economic perspective were there a MANPAD attack, that's a shoulder-fired missile, the kind that the CIA-backed tribesmen used in Afghanistan back when they were on our side against the Russians, and were able to, at least in this model, show a fair amount of economic loss. In fact, that's the main economic loss, is due to people changing their behavior. So this notion of dynamics of risk perception, it changes over time, it changes in response to an event. It's hard to say in isolation. I was fascinated by the conversation earlier about adaptation. As a species, this is probably somehow hardwired into what we do. And in some situations, it may be more or less adaptive as a species. It is unclear. In some situations, I think if I were living in the 30s in Central Europe, in Germany, and I was Jewish, somehow panicking about the politics of going, what's going on, might have, you know, been a good idea and have gotten out of that situation. It might have been not a completely irrational thing to panic in that situation. But we see this in natural disasters, industrial accidents, and these asymmetric events. This is just a generic plot of how we see this going, and Bill talked about this a little bit, that there's an event, it causes a rise in perception to that particular risk. There's some sort of elevation of this risk perception, and there's some duration that it stays at that level, and then it dissipates and goes down. And it may or may not go back down to the same level of risk. There could even be a habituation effect where the level of risk perception goes below where it began initially. In other words, people get used to this concern and things simply dissipate. So we've tried to study psychological impacts by creating vignettes. We've done some national panels. We've also conducted experiments where we've actually tried to gauge emotional, cognitive, and behavioral intentions to act following some sort of terrorist attack. We've looked at the effects depending upon whether the attack, the type of attack, was it a chemical, biological, nuclear, more conventional attack? Was it something that was more familiar to people? Was it something that perhaps threatened them directly because it was in their specific location? Thinking of control theory from social psychology, is it closer psychologically to them than something far away? And I'm just going to summarize some of these so that I don't have to hear that music. That's quite an effective thing. As I said, we conducted a national panel using a quota sample, somewhat in the same psychometric paradigm that Paul Slovic and his colleagues at Decision Research have pioneered. Don't want to say too much about that, but talk a little bit about the vignette studies that we've conducted. We've as I mentioned, varied attack mode from smallpox, dirty bomb, IEDs, MANPADs, and had an earthquake comparison condition. One where we just set off dirty bombs in the vignettes and varied things like social norm. Did people panic? Actually, think about defining panic in that situation. Panic might be for some people just to stay at home. I mean, some people would be ordered to shelter in place, but others who didn't need to shelter in place might do so anyway. Is that panic, even though you're sort of at home with your doors closed? We've also simulated MANPAD attacks in these vignettes. We actually have a vignette now, an ongoing study, where the attack escalates. You think about a single attack on an airplane. Suppose there was an attack on a jetliner using a shoulder-fired missile once a week for a period of time. I think the dynamics of how people react to that might be quite different. If you think about situations, we actually have a panel now going in Spain where we're only interested in people who actually have experienced personally some sort of direct terrorist activity. And we're interested in the differences in how people habituate and so on. And we're currently working on a vignette where there's a contagious viral attack. One of the things that most contagion models that I've looked at, both agent-based and system dynamics models, don't account for is the extent to which people actually do change their behavior. They actually do stay home and avoid contact with other people. And in fact, generally speaking, most models overestimate the speed at which contagion is going to occur and the extent to which, well, why is that? Why, you know, what are we missing in those models? There's clearly some psychological component of how we act that is missing in those models. Actually, speaking of fear and loathing, we actually have found it hard in some cases. People aren't afraid of terrorism that much anymore. And so one of the things that we're doing is actually adding video and audio to try to make them more realistic, to capture somehow the emotional component. When you think about terrorism in a cold, cognitive way, and you think about the irrationality or rationality of various behaviors, that's quite different than getting caught up and having this visceral or emotional response. And one way of doing that with our subjects is to create these vignettes with video and voiceover that sound a little bit scarier. And let me just finish up, because I'm down under a minute now. I think the next direction we want to go with this, there's actually some people at USC in computer science who are building a virtual world to essentially study how people behave their own platform, like a World of Warcraft, Second Life, where they essentially have built into the platform the ability to study how people behave in that virtual world. I think this is an awesome direction to go in order to study how people behave in groups to events that might be considered disasters. At any one time, there are several million people in this country alone playing World of Warcraft. I have two sons who probably will be playing it this afternoon as soon as they get home from school. And it sounds like a few other people have sons who do that too. It's an amazing, for psychologists who want to study human behavior, it has all of the experimental realism that one would ever want, as much as Milgram or anybody else had. These people are really involved in that. Okay.
I'm just amazed at Bill Burns' prediction where exactly halfway through and the initial stimulus is no longer having its effect.
Right, right.
So, I'll have to include that in future presentations.
Next is Mark, and if you want the...
It's okay. Don't
touch
it. Thank you. My background is in risk assessment of buildings, bridges, and other civil engineering infrastructure. And the purpose of that is really to assess the cost effectiveness of actually protecting these important items of infrastructure against a whole range of natural hazards, you know, earthquakes, floods, cyclones, and so on. And it just seems to me that terrorism is another hazard that society faces, and maybe we should be trying to apply similar types of rigor to terrorism, what we do for a whole range of natural hazards. So, you know, as an engineer, I like to express risk in terms of numbers, so I like numbers, I'm very comfortable with numbers, but they're an objective way to compare one hazard against the other in terms of risk. A lot of work I've seen on risk tends to focus on vulnerabilities and worst-case scenarios. I was interested what Bruce said yesterday with the DHS, how they employ science fiction writers. In terms of worst-case scenario, you know, you can only think of the havoc that Al-Qaeda would wreak if they had access to a time machine. It's just, you know, where do you draw the line, right, in terms of worst-case scenarios? So if we want to sort of look at the costs and benefits and the risks, we need to know something about what is actual threat probability, what is going to be the consequences of a terrorist attack in terms of dollars or loss of life or some other quantitative measure. And if we do want to invest money to have counterterrorism protective measures, how effective are they going to be? And ultimately, we're trying to decide, should we do something, or is it cost effective to actually do nothing at all and invest our resources in other hazards which we think we get more benefits for the amount of money that is going to be invested? So risk, in most of the work I'm doing, is really the threat probability times the consequence. So it can be like expected losses, expected damages, fatalities per year. So now there's a fairly generic flowchart for risk-based decision-making. And the main thing I want to point to is it's very important to, is once we calculate the risk, in terms of what do we do? Right? How do we decide whether that risk is going to be acceptable or tolerable to society? And that's where we determine, do we do something? Or is actually the risk so low, we really don't need to do anything at all? Now, if you look at the DHS, they have a National Infrastructure Protection Plan. When I first saw this, I thought, fantastic, that, you know, it sounds really good. They say they do a risk-based approach. I thought, fantastic. They talk about, you know, consequences, vulnerabilities, threats. But in the end of it, they really focus on vulnerabilities. They don't really talk much about the likelihood of those events occurring. And with the risk-based, or what they call a risk management approach, they actually go straight to prioritising where they're going to spend the money. So they immediately assume that we should be doing something. They've actually left out that important step in risk assessment is, are the risks acceptable? Right? And so it took me like an hour of reading just to figure that out, because the veneer was really, it sounded really perfect, but that wasn't the case. So that's not risk management in my book. And obviously there's a high degree of risk aversion with the DHS. That's not particularly new. So the last few years I've been working in probabilistic terrorism risk assessment, where we really try to quantify those five parameters there. Some are going to be easier than others, oops, but that's what research is about, right? Is to try and get a feel, try and get a feel for this. So the objective is to really to optimise the mix of counterterrorism protective measures, or even do we need them at all, right? And it's going to be decision support. It's not decision making, right? It gives decision makers some information which might help them go in one direction or the other, but it's not black and white. It won't decide exactly what you must do. It just really informs the decision maker. And there's a whole various ways you can couch this. One way I quite like is the net benefit. Right, so what's the benefits minus the costs? Right, if it's a positive value, you get a positive net benefit, then that could be a good way, a good means to invest public funds. And this is what we do for a whole range of other infrastructure like power plants, aircraft design. So there's really nothing new here. What's new or novel is really the hazard which we are really, really applying this to. I've done a fair bit of work on infrastructure, bridges, buildings, and so on. What I want to talk today is some work I've done with John Mueller on really aviation security, particularly air marshals. So there's a whole range of measures which are meant to keep us safe in terms of when we fly. The TSA list 20 layers of security, right? That's obviously defence in depth. The issue is do we need 20 layers? Do we need 19? 23? Do we need 10? And I really haven't seen too much assessment of really, you know, where do we draw the line? Right? Where do we draw the line? Particularly when there's large amounts of expenditure spent on this. So let's just look at one example of the Federal Air Marshal Service. We look at that because it's very expensive. It costs nearly $1 billion a year for that program. And so that's a large amount of public money. Okay, so there's a very simple mathematical model, and I won't even show the equation yet, but you know, so this is a very simple overview, right, without getting too detailed in such a short talk. But one thing I want to know is, well, what's the probability of attack? What is the threat probability? So we could argue that there's one attack on 9/11. Al-Qaeda had a publicly stated threat against the US since probably the decade before then. So one attack in 10 years. Right? So maybe a probability attack of 1 in 10 might be a reasonable ballpark figure. Right? There's been no attack since then, so you might argue that maybe it should be less than that. But for sake of illustration, let's say it's 0.1. What is the risk reduction by the Federal Air Marshal Service? Now, since the events of 9/11, even during the events of 9/11, when passengers realised that their lives were threatened by the hijacking, they fought back. Right? And that's why that fourth aircraft crashed in Pennsylvania, because the passengers fought back. So the flying crew are going to fight back, so the paradigm has shifted than what happened before 9/11. So let's just assume that the risk reduction we might get from air marshals might be the same as passengers flying back and carbon cockpit doors, say 16%. Air marshals are only on 5 or 10% of aircraft. So that's assuming that they're on a plane. that the, let's say they're only on 10% of aircraft, so actually across the whole mix of aircraft, the risk reduction of air marshals is really much, much smaller. Right? It's only 1.67%. Right? Now, you can argue about the number, but it's going to be a small number compared to the others, which are always there. Right? Air marshals are not on every single plane. Security costs, and they cost about $900 million per year. In terms of what the consequences are going to be, well, which again, ballpark numbers, let's assume a future aircraft attack might kill 1,500 people in the building. The building has to be rebuilt. We can attach the value of human life and work out that's about $7.5 billion for loss of life, and so on. Loss of GDP or loss of business or the broader ramifications of terror attack will probably dominate. And so let's say we get the nice round number of about $100 million, which is a substantial consequence. If we put this into our formula, so the left-hand side is the benefits, the right-hand side is the cost, and we basically have this net benefits for different attack probabilities, we see they're all negative values. Maybe you can't see it, but they're all negative values. So, if we think our attack probability was 0.1, then the net benefit is we're losing more than $700 million a year on this. In a sense, you're spending $1 and you're getting really 19 cents of benefit. So that's not a particularly good investment. If you think the attack probability is much higher, say it's 0.5, well, one every 2 years, then the net benefit is still negative. So I'd argue that based on this, that they appear to be not cost-effective, just based on this very simple desktop type study. But if you think that some of those parameters should be quantified differently, then you might get a different outcome. But the benefit of this type of approach is it's a transparent decision process. Right? It's not just my opinion versus someone else's opinion. If you don't like these numbers, if you think there's emerging threats, you think these threats might be diminishing, then you can come up with your own numbers and how you could justify, you could quantify threat probability, consequences, and so on, and see whether those mix of numbers changes what the final decision might actually be. So with this type of assumption, this approach, the assumptions can be quantified, be queried, alternative hypotheses can be tested, and the sensitivity of output to results can be made as well. So it's a very open process. There's some final observations, done some other work, compared risks to other natural hazards, and terrorism risk seems much, much lower than the risks we have for most other natural hazards. We need to consider an all-hazards approach rather than focus on one system alone. DHS is obviously highly conservative. Immediately after 9/11, you can understand why some of these implications, why some of these CT measures were in place, but over time you might need a bit more reflection as to whether they're really a worthwhile investment in scarce public funds. Thank you.
Have we got the little turn this way?
Yes. We have to press the door and plug it in.
As I said yesterday, this is intended to give the appearance of doing something useful, not that it's actually doing something.
You're talking about the computer?
You're running Vista, so the chip, the USB would be the reason your computer would crash is infinitesimally small compared to anything else.
Okay, I'm going to begin with a plug for John Mueller's book. You can buy me a drink later. I really liked it. He explored these themes of risk aversion and paranoia in connection with terrorism. And so in my presentation, I'm going to attempt what you might call a British footnote to the themes that he discussed so well. And I particularly admire his effective use of ridicule. I'm not sure whether I'll be able to match his standard. I want to begin with a simple risk management model. I call it the risk thermostat, and the thermostat gets set in the top left-hand corner. Everyone has some propensity to take risks, and that propensity leads to risk-taking behavior, which leads, by definition, to accidents. Taking a risk is doing something that carries with it a probability of an adverse outcome. Through surviving them and learning from them or seeing them on television, being warned by mother, we acquire our perception of what is safe or dangerous. The model proposes that when propensity and perception get out of balance, there's behavior that seeks to restore it. And why do we take risks? There are rewards, and the magnitude of the reward influences propensity. So that's a model of what's perhaps going on in my head when I'm crossing the road. If I wait for dinner, the reward for getting across means that I might accept shorter gaps in the traffic, that sort of thing. You can also, what you might call individual, voluntary, self-controlled risk-taking. But you can imagine institutional arrangements in which you can rig it in ways that profoundly influence the behavior. If I can rig it so that I and a few of my friends reap enormous rewards playing with other people's money, and if we have financial accidents, the pain is very small, together we can bring down the whole of the world economy. But I'm going to focus in my short presentation not on that problem that I characterize as top loop bias, but on bottom loop bias. And that is focusing overwhelmingly on getting accidents down and then still lower and then still lower. Often with no concern for the opportunity costs. Angela touched on that yesterday when she lamented the lack of concern for the costs and, in effect, the opportunity costs of focusing on accidents. And Luke Church yesterday ventured the view that if we focus too hard on making computers completely safe, we'll turn them into useless bricks. That bottom loop bias, certainly in England now, you can find absolutely everywhere. This is risk management in the playground. That's one of the world's safest playgrounds. It's got rubberized matting, it's got barriers, another effective safety measure, no swings. An even more effective safety measure, no children. Now, I inquired what's going on here.
No photographs rule, apparently.
The swings are packed away at night because kids might climb the fence and use them unsupervised and hurt themselves. Now, that is not risk aversion, that is liability aversion. The idea that anyone could think that it's better for the children to play outside in the road than in there their primary concern is not the safety of children. So you have this huge bureaucracy now that is focused on implementing measures that if anything should go wrong, it can't possibly be laid at my doorstep. I was recently in the University of Westminster. They're getting the homeland, the Department of Homeland Security virus. Nobody could tell me what AMBER meant. But in my department at University College London, the geography department, we take it even more seriously. Here's from the inside looking out. Now, if you were to focus down there, you can't see it on that slide, but I'll blow it up for you. We now have bomb blast protection film on all our windows. I work in a hardened target. It makes us feel very important. Now, you can see signs, literally signs, of this sort of bureaucratic paranoia everywhere you look once you start looking for them. That's the sign on the BBC studio door. I could not work out how to exercise the caution that was being urged upon me. Any time on the London Underground, you're like, do not take any risks. What does that mean? Shopping in Marks and Spencer's. Take care. Now the next one, shopping in Sainsbury's. This does on the shopping bag. This does contain, I think, some useful advice. To avoid suffocation, keep away from children.
I feel that way, yes.
This one, I'll blow up those little signs for you. These plants are covered in sharp spikes that may puncture the skin and touch, do not handle. That happens to be the entrance to the health and safety laboratory at Buxton. I now get sent things from all around the world. This next one is from Malaysia.
Oops.
Is that what they do there?
I guess it's a much more and finally, this one from Penrith, keep back from the platform edge, or you may get sucked off. Now, all of these I offer as manifestations of bureaucratic paranoia. But it's now getting worse, from manifestations of paranoia to incitements to paranoia. And everywhere you go on public transport in London now, you encounter these signs. If you see or hear anything suspicious, tell our staff or the police immediately. Trust your senses. Again, if it looks suspicious, say something to our staff or the police. What am I looking for? Sometimes the advice is a bit more specific. It tells you that terrorists live somewhere, so you have to be aware of perhaps your neighbors or whatever. Now, all of this is now starting to backfire. And I think what we're seeing, an increasingly common reaction is to be more afraid of the government than the terrorists. The growing anxiety in response to the surveillance society. What am I doing?
It's very effective. Big Brother is timing you.
Okay, now another set of factors that seems to be very important in trying to understand what is going on. It matters hugely whether a risk is seen as voluntary or imposed. And it also matters whether you feel in control of it. So a pure self-control voluntary risk might be rock climbing. The risk is the reward. You do it for the adrenaline rush. An applied self-controlled voluntary risk might be driving. Unless you're a young man, you do it not for the adrenaline rush, but to get to B. Going on down, that's me on my bicycle. Voluntary, but no control. I may voluntarily get on a plane or a train, but then I hand over control of my fate to the pilot or the driver. Moving down, imposed risks. I use mobile phone masks as an example of the importance of whether or not it's seen as billions of people are queuing up all around the world to take this risk, and the radiation dose that you get from this is orders of magnitude higher than that you get from the mast. But masks are seen as nasty impositions, especially if they're blocking your view. Further down, Monsanto, more relevant to UK than it is to, whoops. Anyway, the numbers almost don't matter. The London bomb killed 6 days worth of death on the road. And you don't get 10,000 people at Trafalgar Square every Sunday lamenting last week's death toll. So my last example of paranoia in response to terrorism, you cannot park your bicycle anywhere near Parliament Square. The police will take it on the grounds that it might be a bicycle bomb. Now that little sign there is actually a little notice saying this bike is a pipe bomb. Now that little notice is supplied by a rock group in Pensacola called "This Bike Is a Pipe Bomb," and they distributed them. And a bicycle at Ohio University had one of these on. The police cordoned off the university and destroyed it, despite the fact that the owner told them about the rock group. Now, I've put on my website an appeal for evidence. Has anyone anywhere ever been killed by a bicycle bomb?
And that got picked up by Cycling Grapevines. That got me onto the BBC morning program and the BBC World Service. I broadcast my appeal worldwide, and so far the actuarial risk of being killed by a bicycle pipe bomb is zero.
But you're inspiring the terrorists.
So if only that many people had listened less than wearing helmets, you actually could have saved lives.
Sorry, say that again.
So compared to the risk of bicycling at that moment, right? So if you
Cycling without a helmet is very safe. We can talk about it later.
It's actually all the time.
Okay. Yeah, hi, thanks very much. I wish you'd gone after me. I don't have any funny photograph to show you. My name's Dan Gardner. I'm a journalist. And in my day job, I am the lowest form of journalist. I am an opinion columnist, but that's not why I'm here. I've written a book on risk perception, which is cleverly called Risk, in Canada, Australia, the UK, and elsewhere, but for reasons unknown, it is called The Science of Fear here in the United States. I even have a different name on the name of the book, by the way, if you're looking for it, Daniel, for some reason. My publisher tells me that Daniel sounds more science-y. Fine art. So, I thought, what on earth can I actually speak to you folks about? I'm a generalist in a room full of specialists, so I'm really here to listen to you. But I thought there is actually one thing that I probably do know a bit more about than some of you might, and that's the news media. And you might also be interested in hearing a little bit about the news media, because, chances are good you've grossed about the news media in the past. The news media play a prominent role in security issues of all sorts. And complaints are legion, shall we say. Let me just run down some of the standards. This is nothing new to any of you, I'm sure. What are some of the problems with news media coverage? Well, we obsess about, we love to cover, vivid, dramatic causes of death, risks, and so on, while we ignore less vivid and less dramatic causes of death. Terrorism is, of course, the classic example. A death caused by terrorism results in screaming headlines, whereas deaths caused by diabetes are not reported. Diabetes will kill more people and more Americans in 1 year than terrorism will ever kill. That is a prediction I know, but I'm comfortable in making it. Novelty. Dog bites man, not a story. Man bites dog, great story. Bad news bias. Good news is practically an oxymoron, of course. There's lots of stories about this, but there's also a lot of great empirical research. There is a very deep and profound bad news bias. And when we deal with risk information, we present it horribly. Something bad could happen, right? This is one of the standard news stories. Something bad could happen. Completely meaningless statement, and yet it's a standard news story. We emphasize relative risk, not the absolute risk. One of my favorites is, and by the way, I'm talking here, of course, about quality media, not talking about tabloids. New York Times story. Women who take a particular drug are at twice the risk of developing a potentially fatal blood clot. Should you be concerned? Damned if I know. Unless you mention the absolute risk. And yet, for all of our mentions of relative risk, when you actually go and look, you'll almost never see the absolute risk, which allows you to make sense of the relative risk. What else do we do? No comparisons for perspective. Even if you're a numerate individual, and you actually, you'll struggle to understand what is one in 135,000. If the media actually provides you with the good information, the good statistics that you need, and we usually won't, we particularly won't when we're talking about juicy stuff like terrorism, if we do provide you those statistics, do we give you what you need to actually make sense of it, to actually bring it into perspective in your own life? One in 135,000, you're all very numerate people, hyper-numerate people. Still, you have to think about that. What does it mean? Well, if I tell you that your annual risk of dying in a car crash is one in 6,000, you got it, right? You've got a sense of perspective. We almost never do that. And then fundamentally, the most basic problem is that we repeat popular misconceptions. There's actually an amazing, we're often considered, condemned for being cynics, but what we are is gullible. We even lack basic skepticism. There's not a lot of critical scrutiny happening. we simply pick up popular notions and repeat them. And that's fine for the public if they're repeating it to your neighbor because, of course, you're speaking on a fence. That's limited damage. But when we do it, of course, it goes rather more broadly. So again, none of this is new to any of you. You all know this. The interesting question is, you know, why do we do it? Why are the media so bad at handling this stuff? There's a number of answers. But the standard ones that you'll see cited constantly by the folks who bemoan the media are two: ideology and money. And I'm not going to deny that ideology and money can play a role in certain circumstances. But if you've ever spent any time in a newsroom and seen how a newscast or a television is actually put together, you'll quickly realize that, in fact, there's probably something else going on. We're just not that organized. We're just not that thoughtful. No, what I argue is essentially this. This is what I would encourage, and I'm not going to get into it in any great detail because there isn't time, but it's this. Why do the media do what they do? They do what they do because reporters are human. Look at the media. Look at the media's flaws through the lens of very basic psychology, and it starts to make a whole lot of sense. Again, just to give you a few samples, bad news bias. I mentioned the bad news bias. Let me go back to that just to flesh out exactly how deep this runs. Early 1990s, as often happens in science, two studies came out. One study said this potential threat to children exists, it's serious, there it is. The other study said that's the bad news. The good news study said exactly the same threat, no threat. Good news study, excellent. They're both published side by side in New England Journal of Medicine, which the media, of course, cover. They're side by side. What a terrific opportunity to see how the media handles this stuff, right? What happens? Researchers went and looked. They found 19 stories on one or either risk. What did they find? None of the stories mentioned only the good news study. 9 of the stories mentioned only the bad news. 10 mentioned both the good news and the bad news. But in every single one of those stories, they actually gave greater prominence to the bad news, much more space, greater prominence to the bad news. So it's very profound. But now ask yourself this. Now, well, sensationalizing, right? We're selling newspapers. Wrong. Bad news bias. The psychological literature on our bias towards bad information, bad news, bad in all sorts of different forms, is voluminous. It is immense. It is basic human. That's our hardwiring. Bad news, we go to it. So journalists are actually going to it for the same reason the audiences go to it. No other. Here's another basic one. Stories. The evening news. What is the evening news? In one sense, it's information, but stories. What happened today? Tell me about your day. What happened today? Right? We're telling stories. All right. Stories. Go to an evolutionary psychologist. Human beings have anything to do with stories? Right. Actually, we do. Yeah. We're narrative machines. We love stories. We make stories. We love hearing stories. Right? And what are the elements of stories? In addition to storytelling is not only universal. Actually, the basic contents of a story are universal as well. What is involved? Novelty. Novelty is good. Conflict, emotion, drama. And of course, the more a story has of these qualities, the better the story is. Right? Well, then go back to that media coverage. Why are they giving such prominence to terrorism stories but not diabetes? Right? Terrorism deaths but not diabetes deaths. It's a better story. And in fact, when you ask editors and reporters, why did you give prominence to this and not that, what you'll often get is a tautology. It'll be a shrug. It's a better story. It's a better story because it's a better story. Well, what you're hearing, of course, is an intuitive response. They can't quite articulate why. They just know. That's an intuitive response. That's human nature talking. What isn't necessary for a good story? Numbers. Right?
Facts.
In fact, exactly. And in fact, they can get in the way of a good story, right? Numbers complicate things. Numbers are messy. And numbers, of course, we have no intuitive wiring for that. The numbers don't compel us. Numbers don't drive our emotions. Numbers don't grab us. So what happens with this? Well, statistics they're kind of necessary. We kind of understand that. We kind of slot them in secondarily, but primarily, we're telling stories, and that's what stories are about. And as a result of this bias, you put this together, there's all sorts of illustrations of this, but one of my favorites is this. Anybody remember a little event called the Miracle on the Hudson?
Yeah. I lecture a lot about this stuff. Many different countries, and I always love using this example. This is one of my latest examples, because it's a little local story, right?
Everybody on the planet knows the Miracle on the Hudson. What was the name of the person involved? Who's the great pilot? Anybody? Sully.
Sully.
Hooah. Great story, right? What does it tell you about air travel safety? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. It's meaningless.
Right? It tells you it's very safe.
Well, if you have Sully as your pilot. Now, what about air travel safety? Well, but I want to understand this risk. I want to understand this concept. Okay, wait. Statistics. Okay. What do we know? Over the last several decades, actually since the dawn of aviation, the line is this, right? It's just getting safer and safer and safer and safer and safer. Really quite a dramatic success story. It's an amazing story. And then, 2007, 2008, something happened. Anybody know what happened? No one died in an air crash in the United States over a two-year period. An astonishing culmination of an amazing trend, completely unreported. And why? I will argue, and this is what I want to leave you with and encourage you with, it's the psychology, you have to analyze it that way. And by the way, Bruce has agreed to allow me to plug something. Now, I'm done that part. I just want to plug this. I'm now working on a new book. It's about expert predictions, why they routinely fail, and why we believe them anyway. A lot of you folks probably have Y2K stories. Anybody have any interesting Y2K stories? Please see me after.
Questions?
Richard, you expressed intrigue and puzzlement about the response to risk of infection. I would submit that people may behave the way they do in response to that sort of threat because here we have genuine biological adaptation. The psychological responses to infection are such that we acquired these by natural selection long ago. After all, infection occurs in much the same way now as it did 2 or 3 million years ago. Now, of course, we also arguably have psychological adaptation to protect us from human predation. In other words, attacks. But attacks take place very differently now than they did several million years ago. That might account for some asymmetry.
Well, infection, I mean, the biological process may be the same, but I would think that whereas many people died of infection even just 100 years ago,
yeah.
Looking beyond 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, or 10,000 years ago, I would guess that things are much different now in terms of cure rates and vaccinations.
Oh, sure. Like that. But what I mean is the avoidance of the contact with the infected individual.
Right. Oh, okay. In terms of a contagious situation.
Yeah.
You know, I had HIV up there. I didn't get a chance to talk about it, but that's a situation where you essentially have the government scaring people a great deal. I know I ask my students now, what do you think the probability of transmission of the HIV virus from one heterosexual encounter, and they all give these grossly overestimated probabilities. And I do the little probability calculation. It's really 1 in 1,000,000. You have a low risk group and all of that, and they're just astonished. And you know, it's like, well, don't tell us that. We'll go out and do this anyway. But I don't think people have necessarily a good intuition for that. I think that they get scared the same way that people get scared about nuclear power or about oil drilling or about Al-Qaeda or anything else.
Well, just a comment, if I may, on that. I think the actual numbers of people dying from infectious diseases has not become less. It certainly has in the United States and Northwest Europe and Australia. One or two other places. 40 million a year right now. Of course, the population is much larger as we look back over millennia. So it really rather depends on where you
this is mostly to Mark. I think one of the things that messes up a lot of these models is that we assume there's just one risk. So a lot of your examples of TSA and DHS overreacting and they must do something versus do nothing, there's a risk they're dealing with, which is the risk of being fired, the risk of being superfluous. And when you look at responses to risk, they're very individual, and they depend on a spectrum of risks that they're trying to juggle at the same time. So the risks to my career will determine I'm going to overreact, because that is a lesser risk to me. A risk to the community is a bigger risk, but it's more diffuse. So whenever you look at these models, I think you have to sort of deal with a spectrum of risks. It makes it a lot harder. And when you're talking about sky marshals, I mean, sort of there are two ways that is wrong. One is we have to look at the deterrence effect. So that the argument will be made that having them is safe even if they're not being used. Of course, the counter argument is not the deterrence effect of sky marshals, it's the deterrent effects of saying we have sky marshals. It actually is a lot cheaper than training them and putting them on planes, just pretending we do. So, again, you know, these things, when you start looking at them, they get a lot more complicated. And I mean, these are good models, and I use them too. I was very, very careful not to make them more simple.
Oh, yeah, no, I really replicated, and this is just a very simple example to illustrate some of the challenges in all of this. The first issue about decision makers being very risk averse because they're worried about their own career is very valid. And it's very hard to capture that in a model, right? And I think we just have to recognise that. But we need to distinguish between risk aversion of individuals, risk aversion from a government, right? Where an individual, I'm looking after myself, but a government has a broader responsibility, and they should be held to a higher level in that sense. But I suppose, though, is that if people are going to be, if individuals will be risk averse, then at least it should be clear what the trade-offs are. Right. So if it's very clear that you spend a dollar and then getting 90 cents of benefits, at least it's very clear that this individual is making the decision for reasons other than what's been best for the economy or the budget. The one about the air marshals is, again, deterrence could well be factored into that. You could argue that either way. And the whole point of these types of models is that you can make those arguments. I would have thought the biggest deterrence for 9/11 is the fact that passengers and crew are going to fight back. They won't just sit back. And that's happened. There was a Qantas attempted hijacking in 2003, and it was the passengers who really fought back. Right? So you'd argue having an air marshal, well, if people think there's an air marshal on a plane, they might sit back and think, oh, let's wait till someone in authority does something. So actually having an air marshal could give you a false sense of security, because 9 times out of 10, they won't be there. So you could argue it either way, but you know, these models, you could have many PhDs on them.
Following on from the medical stories and Bruce's point, linking when risk aversion becomes liability aversion, I assume it's the same on this side of the Atlantic, but medical insurance in Britain for doctors, they have categories low, medium, high, and then off the scale is obstetrics and gynecology. The huge improvement in life expectancy at birth has been one of the most important contributors to the huge increase in population and huge increase in life expectancy generally. So obstetrics and gynecology are arguably about the most successful branch of medicine, and yet they are the most sued. They have got so good that they're supposed to be perfect. and any mishap sends people to their lawyers.
I had something wrong before where I think John, Gene, and I forgot. James. And we'll move back there with that.
A question for Dan. Would you do some comparison with sports reporting? Because if, for example, someone hits 4 home runs in a single game, that's going to be a headline, but the first paragraph will put that in context. How often this happens, whether this guy's in the game group, etc. So it would be better if you put the sports reporters on the front page. May actually be that only people who read baseball stories know a lot about baseball. I mean, you don't have to explain who Babe Ruth was, for example. And if you write stories about diabetes, unfortunately, a lot of people aren't diabetics, read them, so consequently, I don't know, maybe there's something to do with the audience.
That is
but I mean, sports recording has contacts all over the place, and very right at the top.
Oh, the statistical sophistication of both the writers and the audience for sports is very impressive, and I wish they'd bring it to the rest of society.
But I would add to that.
They get stuff wrong all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, but they're trying.
Yeah. At least they're trying.
It's a relative judgment.
The next day it doesn't matter anyway.
They still don't understand basic concepts like, you know, how big a sample size needs to be for something to be significant, and
they believe in hot hands in basketball, etc. Yeah. 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 Oh, absolutely. I'm not saying that they're an ideal. But they actually have numbers in the story, which is nice.
Bar's really low here.
Okay, this is a less cheery question. It's not about baseball, but we've had a huge discussion about whether or not, in the political sphere, about whether or not Al Qaeda is, you know, the terrorists, the criminals, and the terrorists, you know, that we got a war on terror. And then on the flip side, there's the assault on women's services providers, right? Which is, you know, 1,000 anthrax or pseudo anthrax attacks, 12 murders, bombings, and that's very clearly defined as crime. So, and now, you know, each time a women's health services provider is shot, there's a call out, let's call this terrorism, let's call this, you know, the domestic Taliban. And I'm wondering if it's labeled and said, look, you know, this is it crime or is it terrorism, is a semantic point. But the question is, would the impact, like we labeling it and saying this is, you know, a terrorist campaign, would that change the effect and make it, in a sense, more effective, right? So what when you look at people's response to terrorist attacks, the people I'm interested in are, you know, nurses and doctors, because women need health care and they don't, right? So if we said, well, this is a terrorist movement, this is as opposed to these are a bunch of criminal nut jobs that we just somehow can't get rid of, would that change the response in the news?
I have a comment on that. The answer is absolutely yes. Had we framed 9/11 the way I think it really should have been framed, as an international crime, I think the response and put all the investigation in the hands of law enforcement, all that, chances are probably good we may have even caught a lot more terrorists. But we would have also impacted the attractiveness of the recruiting environment for terrorists. Because once you call it a war, the whole dynamics change. And there's a great literature I can talk to you about over lunch, maybe. But that was arguably one of the biggest mistakes, I think, that happened after 9/11. It does change the dynamics because labeled as a crime is a lot more manageable, people, perceptually, than a war. War is a bit, you know, is a different stage. It's a different theater.
Let's add a little something to that. This may be slightly tangential to what you're saying, but I often get asked, when people behave in emergencies, are they more likely to panic if they know it's a terrorist attack as opposed to a natural disaster? And the kind of jury is out in that we don't have a lot of behavioural evidence to suggest that there's a marked difference between the two, but there certainly often is more anxiety when things happen and people go, is it a terrorist attack or is it just an electrical fall, which has happened on 7/7 in the time after the bombs went off. And there were allegations that people were trying to downplay it and say, oh no, it's just an overload, because there was a fear that if people realised it was a terrorist attack, then they'd all stampede. I think that fear is unfounded in behavioural terms, but certainly in people's anxiety levels, there could certainly be more anxiety. Whether that translates into actual behaviour is a very different question.
So, kind of to do with the panic model that you're discussing. So you showed this picture of people taking pictures of the disaster and space and whatnot, and you mentioned that, you know, you would say that that wasn't representative of panic, or people panicking in this disaster situation. But I wonder if the amount of panic is relative to the proximity of danger. So this picture, obviously, people had escaped the dust cloud already. They were a little ways away from, you know, kind of the major danger. And one example I bring up, which doesn't necessarily have to do with panic, but if you think of Black Friday, there have been cases this last year where people were trampled to death at the front of lines, right? So they open the doors and people kind of make this big rush, right? And so the people at the back of the line probably aren't as anxious to make this big rush or this huge push as the people in front of the line. So the danger is at the front of the line as opposed to the back of the line. You never hear a story about someone at the very back of the line being trampled to death. So I wonder if it's an issue of pictures just aren't taken close enough to the proximity of the danger to really see this panic.
Was a couple of things there. First of all, after the bombs went off on 7/7, there was a lot of mobile phone footage that went out of people actually in the direct proximity of where bombs went off. So I don't know if that makes any difference. But, and I don't know what Black Friday is, but I'm talking of evidence of other fires have happened, that when there is a crush for people to get to the doors, and the drawing I have, which I'm happy to show people later, is a description of how bodies pile up at an exit in a fire, and that's used as an example of panic. You often look at the demographics of people rarely use all fire exits sensibly, so I'd be quite confident that if an alarm went off now, most people would evacuate by the way that they entered rather than by the clearest fire exit. And that causes a problem in fires to do with the spread of the fire, in that if you reach a point where you haven't used the other exits because you're not familiar with them, and then you go to the way that you came in, and everyone else does, you have a problem of just physical crush of people trying to get out. But that's an information problem, in that people are not made aware of other possible exits, as opposed to a panic problem.
I'll give you a great example to your question. I had lunch with the principal investigator that looked at what actually happened inside the Twin Towers. This person surveyed thousands of people that came down the towers and rightly said just about everybody below where the plane struck got out. What he described to me was that there was tremendous orderly behavior coming down the steps to get out, and altruistic behavior, other people helping those who are having a tough time getting out. That's, you're not going to get any more proximal than being inside the towers. I think, is it Jean in the, that you asked yesterday or today about an example of panic? You know, I've experienced panic only in one case, and if any of you have ever been a lifeguard, any lifeguards in here? Anybody ever had to rescue a drowning person? That's the purest example of panic. Yeah, well, yeah. There you see panic, and it's very different than the pictures that we saw here. This is where someone will try to drown you to stay on top of the water, even though you're the only person, you're the only thing that's really going to rescue this individual. And you can see it. It's very, very different. But there's tremendous confusion on this issue, and an incident commander out on the West Coast once took this very picture, you know, these things, and offered that to me as evidence of panic. It's completely wrong. These people were behaving rationally. That's what you want people to do in the face of emergency.
Yeah, one comment I would make, though, is that we don't have any pictures of what the people did above where the planes left.
Yeah.
And in fact, we know that many of them jumped out of the building.
Yeah.
And you know, perhaps that was rational if you think about dying from fire versus one last final jump out the window. That's probably, you know, better than dying in fire.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I would make that decision too. But one, I mean, we don't know how much panic there was above the planes, especially once people figured out that they were going to die.
Mm-hmm.
Just quickly add to that, that there's very little evidence because you can't interview people that died, but the evidence that there is appears to support the idea that if people know they're going to die, they become apathetic. If they know there's no chance for them to evacuate, what's the point in competing with other people? They just accept their fate and go, "All right, we're going to die."
Don't we have a number of phone calls from people who knew they were trapped and you know, and called people or left messages, and
yeah.
It would, you know, it also goes against the idea that there is panic.
Yeah, that's a very good point. That we do have evidence of that. A lot of them was concerned for family. They were reassuring, things like that. Yeah,
we
absolutely.
Have the ones that were released. We don't know about the ones that people made that were perhaps less socially acceptable.
A question for Mark, following up on the discussion about the air marshals again. What about the introduction of new risks? I mean, there seems to be a missing feedback loop there on the analysis. Is what about the new risks introduced by each of the responses? For instance, the air marshal risk, there's a risk, as we heard yesterday, of deception being introduced by that, as well as the risk of people sitting down and saying, well, I'll let the air marshal take care of this, I won't risk myself. But also the risk introduced by somebody pretending to be an air marshal and being involved in the plot.
Yeah, you can cover all those issues in the framework. What I did here was really just to, it's a bit, what I did here was really like risk green, to say, you know, these are our ballpark estimates or our best guesses, make it very simple, to see roughly where we are. Right? And you know, this, I think no matter how I play around with the numbers, I'm still getting the disruptive perspective. I did a similar study where I looked at the hardening of cockpit doors, and that was extremely a cost-effective measure, you know, because that's a passive measure, it's always there. So you can use that method to show that something's are cost-effective and something's aren't. It just really depends on the amount of detail and how much time you want to put into this. And sure, I can see 20 years of research almost in that alone, just to look at all the different issues. And that's why it's interesting, is that it is a transparent approach. And you can factor things in or take them out and see how it changes. But yeah, you can, and really, to look at this, you want to look at the whole system, not just air marshals, but, you know, passenger screening, cargo screening. You really want to look at everything in one go, all that's approach in one go, to try and, you know, see how different measures work.
In terms of benefit, though, in addition to deterrence, which I think is hard to measure, but certainly that was one intention, another, I think, intended benefit was that it would make people feel safer. And in terms of the real impact, if you could get more people to fly, if you can get the economy, for example, to respond in a more reasonable way, the $1 billion a year, it seems like $1 billion used to mean something more than it does now. But it seems like that might actually be a relatively small, if you think that there's some advantage to
I think at the time it was a rational thing to do, to get people confidence again. But after 8 years, I think you need to revisit some of those decisions and make it haste.
Kind of like paying farmers to get rid of crops.
Yeah.
But it's the idea of sky marshals as a deterrence, not the reality of it.
So, Marcus, for you?
Well, that is part of the reality. The people's response is part of reality.
But you could fire most of them, not tell the news media, and they'd be just as effective.
Well, for all we know.
They would be
just as effective because people wouldn't like that.
So just to add something to the, to the mind of everything, actually a couple, it's actually not accurate. And some of the people actually who were below the fire didn't get out because there was during the evacuation there was an announcement that only the other building was affected. And so all Japanese employees went back to work. They were infected by this. So that's number one. And number two is actually I've spoken to a lot of the people who evacuated simply because I have a personal contact to one of the companies. And actually the people who were there during the 1919 bombing in the car park, if you remember, actually what they said is the most striking thing about the whole evacuation was the impact of the regular fire evacuation drills the Port Authority had put in place. So it was huge because during the evacuation in 1994. It was a total shambles. And so many problems. And basically, they had 6 months of evacuation drills after. And everybody said how hugely effective that was. And that contributed so much to the calm, the helpfulness, and everything. And I think it often gets overlooked as some of this boring, sort of like routine behavior and regular drills is so important to actually get a grip on the behavior.
I just wanted to pick up on a point that Bruce made in part of his question to Mark about uncertainty. And it's about uncertainty as a defensive method against risk and threats, which is often overlooked. There is a tendency, it seems, obviously to create certainty about security, to lose sight of uncertainty as a defense. And one of the most prominent examples in the United States of response to the anthrax attacks is creating a select list of agents which are ones on which you take certain measures, which with smallpox at the top, which doesn't occur in nature, of course, and the which inhibits international collaboration when those particular agents are listed. That's one thing it does, and therefore creates the vulnerability in terms of a longer-term response, but also sends a signal to intending biological terrorists of the things to avoid, and so they can act accordingly. So that's a creating certainty, and perhaps in many ways creating more dangers. And there are plenty of examples in non-human behavior of uncertainty being used as a defense. So I wonder if I know Mark could comment on that, particularly airline security is an area where certainty is. You could argue that it has to be that way. Is that correct?
I think people like certainty, but when we do the models, we need to model the uncertainty of human response and of the terrorist approach as well. So a lot of this work is really uncertainty modeling, because we don't know for certain, you know, what the next mode attack could be, how passengers could react, how air marshals could react, how the door could react. So there's uncertainty to all of those aspects, and we need to capture that somehow in the model.
But I think that really you're interested in the uncertainty and how it affects the terrorist or the attacker, and I think all of the work that I've seen and that I've participated in suggests that in fact most terrorists, Al-Qaeda at the top, is relatively risk averse. And I know Jim Pita talked yesterday about a system that's in place at LAX for airport security, and in fact Malin Timbe and James are working on a system now for the air marshals, looking at what the best allocation of air marshals would be, how many you need, how you need to randomize, and so on. And I think that you're absolutely right. The randomization, that increasing uncertainty for the terrorist and reducing uncertainty is absolutely a defense. And that's one that I think James and Melinda and some others at CREATE have sort of pioneered that idea with DHS, that you want to randomize. That's a real effective way of dealing with
it. I was thinking more of a risk to the success of the terrorist operation. I know that they're not risk averse.
Well, I think they are risk averse.
Their operation to succeed.
Well, I think they are risk averse. They've gone on record, and if you look, they have really a quite high probability that they have to have a success before they'll go forward with an attack. Last year I talked about a model that tried to model a terrorist agent in terms of a rational decision analytic model. And one of the things that we built into that were utility functions that were risk averse, based on just about interviews we had across the board with anyone who knows anything about terrorism. And they were extremely, I mean, that may be counterintuitive, but I think
the threshold for the probability success that I've heard from fairly high up in DHS is 80% to 90% probability of success on a big mission. And if you think about it,
that's
makes sense. Huh?
89% good success.
No, 80% to 90%.
80% to 90%.
I've heard over 70,
yeah.
At least.
Did the terrorists be successful?
No,
that's what their threshold is, and it makes, yeah, and the logic behind part of that is that they have multiple constituencies. If they make a big attempt and they're caught, they're thwarted, the recruiting environment goes way down. It's part of the culture, and so that's why it's so high.
So uncertainty would be creating uncertainty.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No question about it.
On the other hand, you have to beware of security by obscurity. Some supposed deception can be easily detected.
Okay, well, let's thank the panel. Anyone who's, I believe the food talk's out again?
Yes.
Anyone who is interested in a stroll to get pizza for about a 15-minute walk and then bringing it back and eating it, that would be a major of the time.
What do you know about?
I'm going to hang out for lunch.
I figure it's a 25-minute walk.
Yesterday, beautiful,
and
let's see. I don't know if I walk around.